This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, thank you all. Amazing diversity in our understanding and our, yes, our resonance with Memorial Day. There's also a singularity of death, maybe, and suffering. And since Buddhism in general is generally about suffering, about human suffering, there are three marks of Buddhism. One of them is suffering. The other two are non-self and change. Everything's changing. But I thought I'd talk a little bit about our practice with the idea that the motivation for our practice is primarily to get at the suffering and to contribute to the alleviation of suffering, both within ourselves and generally for humanity. And the amount of suffering, if you look at the news and the millions of people who are displaced, and also all of us who are suffering from various afflictions and handicaps and tragedies within our families and so on, it's and friends, sangha members, teachers. So our practice is basically just this. That was a famous koan about 1,000 years ago, characterizing the teaching of one very prominent master. When asked what his teaching was about, what should be said about his teaching, he said it was just this. And we can see that just this is this sitting posture, sitting upright, sincere, without pride, from the Metta Sutra. But also, in that, there is awareness as a very strong part of that, and breath, attention to your breathing, all of which seem to go together very nicely. There's also a number of sutras. There's a sutra on the full awareness of breathing. There's the four foundations of mindfulness, which are primarily dealing with the components or the diversity of awareness within us, awareness of feelings, thinking, body, senses, sensations, change. Everything is changing. And with that awareness, there's consequent dissolution of at least unwarranted desires. If you're really aware of your senses and your body and your feelings and your mind, you have quite a bit in mind and in concept. So it does tend to help dissolve the immediate tendency to grasp. And you can, in that, Brother David, who is very closely associated with Zendo, had a formula of stop, look, and go. You know, what a child is told to do when he crosses the street. In our breath, in our sitting, in our general posture, that's a good way of characterizing it. He gave a talk on TED talk on this, and I think it's had something like 5 million hits so far, 5 million viewers. So it's a very famous lesson. But there are also the seven aspects of awakening that go into that. The mindfulness is the cornerstone, and investigation of what is this? Who is? What's happening? And why? And with that, there is, in the sitting posture, generally increasing internal factors arising, joy, energy, peace, and those contribute to concentration and equanimity, constancy. And that in turn leads to various stages of concentration, meditation. First just sitting, thinking, pondering, but then with extended practice, eventually just sitting, non-thinking, fully aware, fully present, And then beyond that, just sitting non-thinking, non-hindering, you let thoughts, feelings, sensations, senses, impressions, impulses go. You let them flow, but you're just sitting. It's just sitting. There is sitting. But the basic principle is just breathing in and breathing out. Breathing in, we are nothing. And everything that is in our mind and our senses. Breathing out, we let things go. The impulses, the thoughts, the feelings, the trains of thoughts, the planning, thinking, analyzing, trying to focus on some particular thing of interest to you. Let all that go, and we also let the body sensations, there are waves and currents and tides of sensations that are continuous, sense impressions, continuous within the body. And they're, I think Suzuki Roshi was the one who said something like, when we sit, we are nothing. We don't even realize what we are. When we get up, we resume our normal egocentric thinking, conceptual being. So we just recreate ourselves, we recreate everything in that process. He also talked about big mind as a focus. So when you're sitting upright, you're aware of boundlessness. That's a key theme of another sutra, a Heart Sutra. Boundlessness and form, balancing each other. Boundlessness is form, formless is boundlessness. But sitting without thinking and without hindering is boundlessness. You have the skin bag that you're aware of, and you are aware of what's inside of it and senses and sensations, but you're also aware of the space. And eventually the consciousness that sort of pervades space. And that, in turn, is what is Suzuki Roshi, since I'm talking about him, he was the author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is probably the most famous Zen book in America, in the English language, best-selling. He also said something like, not one, not two is a very important teaching. I think Eric talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but not one being one thing or one object or one concept, one self that we can grasp and put forward as being ourselves. We have this ego that we get up and recreate and we use to work with, play with, socialize with, and we also have the no self, no permanent self, change, ongoing change. He also said that when we sit, we can't really sense or reach with our senses the truth of the source. But through the practice of Zazen, we may realize it. Koban Roshi talked about our root teacher here at Jikoji, talked about sitting as being the disappearing. So disappearing to yourself. The ego, when you get tired of analyzing what you thought, what your plans are, what your thinking of doing next or what on earth is this about, you come back to letting that go, being nothing. Essentially, after some time, usually, disappearing means that you forget about breathing in and breathing out particularly, or any particular direction of mindfulness or awareness, and you're just sitting. The Dalai Lama had some striking words. This is going a little bit of parallel to our teaching into Tibetan Buddhism, but they had some very nice thoughts. And he talks about the process of sitting. In Zen, we sometimes talk about silent illumination as being this sitting in big mind. But Tibetan Buddhism, he uses he talks about innermost awareness as being what we're sitting, what is in sitting. Maybe not, it's not a personal thing, it's not a possession, it's not mine or me. It's just, in his terms, the fundamental innate mind of clear light, or the fundamental innate wisdom of clear light, or jewel mind, or ordinary consciousness, and innermost awareness, self-release, naked release, unimpeded penetration, primordially, naturally arisen innermost awareness, diamond mind of clear light. There's also others in Tibet who've talked about just present, fresh awareness, or this present presence, or cognizant emptiness, vast space, nothing holy. So the Dalai Lama in his article says, stop thinking for a while. And then he talks about shock. He says, you need to avoid even bliss, clarity, and non-conceptuality. Therefore, shout. Pow! Imoho. And he goes on to say that those tend to clear, bring back and restore us to this, whatever you want to call it. But it's not a thing, so it sort of falls within the paradox of not one, not two. Maybe we're nothing, maybe we're zero, maybe we're infinite, we're everything within our possible awareness. Maybe it's just the mind, the neurons, various, many, many rooms in the mansion of the mind, and it's just all of them playing concurrently in this. There's a lot of paradox, even in every discipline within science about what really is. When you get down to the base of it, in science, we can only go so far. Getting back to practice, which is our current thesis for this talk, what do we do for practice in our life? Thich Nhat Hanh had something that he said that I really love, that's peace is all around us and within us. This is not some ideal or concept. Reaching peace, touching on peace, we can be healed and transformed. It's not a matter of theory, it's a matter of practice. I think if you center on peace, that's one direction for mindfulness practice and for being. If you center on truth, that's another sort of room in this manifold mansion of diversity that we're in. But ideals in general, to me, are almost parallel to the idea of a single God. When you focus on any one of them, what you have is one oneness again. And in our practice, it's not one, not two. We don't deny anything. We don't deny any ideal. We practice love, many of us. But we also practice the sitting. So Köppen had one paragraph that I'd like to read almost in conclusion. When he discussed why we sit. And this was done in a very late stage of his life in a company of senior practitioners, of senior followers, his disciples, essentially. Oops. He was asked, why do we sit? Since you're not doing anything, nothing's happening, and you're certainly not attaining, or else you're in deep trouble, and you're not pushing things away or getting rid of things necessarily. It is a process of transformation, but it's non-gaining is one of the key teachings. So Kelvin said, this gets back to the question of meaning. We sit to make life meaningful. The significance of our life is not experienced in striving to create some perfect thing, not trying to be peace, not trying to be truth, not trying to be love. We must simply start with accepting ourselves. Sitting brings us back to actually who and where we are. This can be very, very painful. Self-acceptance is the hardest thing to do. If we can't accept ourselves, we are living in ignorance this darkest night. We may still be awake, but we don't know where we are. We cannot see. The mind has no light. Practice is this candle in our very darkest room. Köppen. It's the conclusion and the focus of a book called something like Clear Light by Carolyn Atkinson. I think the title's wrong, but the book author is right.
You can also find that quotation on Wikipedia if you look at
Köppen. Oh, and on Jikoji's website, I'm sure.
No, yeah, just the wiki.
So Dogen had a poem. Dogen being, this is sort of saying, Köppen saying, I think, says that practice, independent of what we practice, whether we're practicing mostly Christianity or some branch of it, or Kashmir Shamanism or Hinduism, the practice is what results, I think, from meaning. From meaning you derive purpose and effort. Consequently, and that practice, if it continues for long enough in any room, in any church, will result in virtue, particularly toward other people, and presumably happiness as well. I haven't quite, penetrated to the end of that. But, Dogen's poem, if I can remember correctly, and I haven't tried to memorize it, something like, the heart of Buddha's teachings, the heart of the Buddha's activities, the turning of the ancestor's wheel, it moves along with your non-thinking, and it is completed in the realm of your non-hindering. If it moves within your non-thinking, this movement is completeness. If it is completed in the realm of near non-hindering, completeness itself is realization. I missed some part of that. I'll come back to it later, maybe. But then he said about practice. In deepest water, a fish swims like a fish. Vast sky throughout, transparent sky throughout. A bird flies like a bird. Aha. If its appearance is immediate, you have no defilements. When you have no defilements, you are in immediacy. And in the realization comes effort without desire. So this relates to the meaning and practice, and the effort that goes into that is without personal desire. It's not quite like that, so I'll have to quit on that failing of my memory and open it up for questions. I don't know what time it is. So.
10:12.
Oh, we have 20 minutes at least, so lots of time for a discussion. Jhana, thank you.
So what happens after stepping beyond the many and the one?
First you go to zero and then you go to infinity, but there is no singularity. So, not one, not two.
Yeah. Say you can step beyond one.
Yeah. When everything returns to the one, where does the one go?
You gotta teach you more often.
Please.
You mentioned the word non-thinking. What does non-thinking mean?
Thinking, not thinking.
Sorry?
Thinking, not thinking. There's a famous koan, if you'd like a little bit more detail, but this monk. Was asked what he was doing when he was sitting zazen. He said, not thinking. And the person, the other monk who was asking, said, how do you think non-thinking? He said, thinking non-thinking. So it's that investigation. I think we are alive without our mind being busy. And, you know, I'd like to know many dimensions of that. But in zazen, when we breathe in and are nothing, just as a projection of our minds, if we want, or we can project our minds to include the jet that's flying overhead, or the car, or the trees and the birds, and bring those into our awareness. And that expansion of the mind is not thought. It may be conceptual, but eventually that drops away too, and the barriers drop away, the boundaries. So that to me is part of non-thinking. But then you breathe out and you let everything go. And in that there are all kinds of things happening. One of the key things that you want to let go is whoever thinks that he is letting everything go. So the immediacy of the ego, if the ego thinks it's doing something, put it back into the fire. let it flow with the tide and disappear into the ocean of sensations and senses and feelings, thoughts, plans. It's a practice. I know everybody here, at least my guess is that everybody here can practice this breathing awareness for at most about as long as you can surf without falling into the waves. Not very long. It's a gift. And it brings us closer to the source and to the truth and to the light, the inner wisdom, inner awareness, in the Dalai Lama's terms. Thank you for the question.
On his question, what's thinking?
What's thinking is all these billions of neurons that are really busy in your mind, and it's also the awareness that picks out a particular topic as being, hey, this is, and it's also ego, because the ego is part of that mechanism. And God only knows, or Buddha only knows, what else is part of thinking. But thinking is, the human imagination is as vast a universe as the actual reality that underlies us, that, you know. This isn't real, and this isn't real, but at least it's solid. So in the human imagination, it's just an incredible, vast universe, as you know, from Shakespeare, from any dimension, from art. Not one, not two. I don't know. Please.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. We are very diversified. And if you're looking at, besides the sleeping time we have on a regular daily basis, our minds are always busy, whether it be a multimedia and the telephone, or even if you sit there, probably majority of our mind is very busy. So thought does come in every second. So what do you think about technique like using counting down from 1 to 10, from 10 to 1, where that bring at least a tool to the stop thinking? Maybe, you know, you mentioned about visualization, bring the mountains, bring the trees. I thought that's also very good. That also can be very important too. But what do you think about counting up or down with that, helping the stopping thinking?
I've done that off and on for, you know, experimented with it for many years. Coben, our teacher, said it was like knitting. So I sort of infer from that he didn't have a high opinion of its, you know, effectiveness in bringing us to innermost awareness. The only thing we can do is to return to our practice. And if it's counting, it works.
Okay.
If it doesn't work, there are other, you know, ways.
Another way would be observing. Because as you mentioned earlier, you know, the more you're resistant to the, you want to stop thinking, whatever you have with some argument with your family, whatever, when you try to stop thinking, the thinking actually getting stronger.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a resistance to that.
Yeah.
So, but if you acknowledge it, just observe it, maybe it can go low, you know, weakening that effect. I'm not sure, I'm just the suggestion.
No, if I may, that was what my teacher used to say, that the train of thought comes into the station,
mm-hmm.
but you don't have to get on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You can watch the train and watch it go away again and not jump on it.
Good.
Sorry, cool.
She also said, and I think that she's been on that train many times before. She knows what happens if she gets on it. So, need to do it. Again.
Uchiyama Roshi, he said, the mind produces thoughts like the body produces sweat.
Hmm.
And we don't sit around going, oh, that's good. So the idea of paying so much attention to all of that.
Mm-hmm.
What you're referring to.
Yeah.
Stopping it can be really challenging.
Yeah, we don't want to stop it. We want to be aware and practice.
I've been doing this a fair long time now, and it's not infrequently that I still wonder, am I really a Buddhist? Despite all these years and all this reading, and things come up again and again, and you said something early about Buddhism is about suffering and escape from suffering. And on one level, I agree with that, but it rubs me wrong whenever I hear it. I always feel like, no, it's more, for me, what you said later about investigating and what is this, and what is this about, and that. And at this point, I have given up on that whole project of I'm going to do this and escape from suffering. It's not even oriented that way. And perhaps I'm not a Buddhist, if I'm not. But I read something this morning that summed it up nicely, I guess. And forgive me for bringing up basketball, but I'm not the first one. Someone tells me. Yeah, been quite a week. And there's a blogger. He's a Harvard lawyer and a huge Warrior fan. I read him from time to time. He's eloquent, of course, like a Harvard lawyer ought to be. And he ended his little blog with this paragraph, because he's been a long-suffering Warrior fan for decades. That it's all worth it, for this moment. And he said, I wouldn't trade all that suffering for anything. That, and he didn't put it this way, but I know, that all that suffering provides a rich backdrop to the joy of living and when things happen. And if I want Buddhism to do something for me, in that kind of, it's to appreciate that I can accept my frailties, some of what Gobind was talking about, and suffering, and integrate it and see, not, its meaning, not make it mean, but just see what's there. And it's funny how, this guy I imagine is not a Buddhist, but to me what he said was a little paragraph of Dharma talk, because I just got it, It's like, yeah, in the context of this show, and I've never been, I'm a fair weather fan, I can't stand to suffer through long losing streaks, but I knew what he meant, and I understood what he meant, so. And am I a Buddhist? I don't know. But I do believe this practice can help with tying these extremities of our existence.
I think one thing to mention is that the word was dukkha, as we all know. It's a little bit different than suffering. It may be unnecessary suffering that it's talking about that we impose on ourselves. And dukkha, one translation, is misalignment. So we each have a true nature. Whatever is given at this moment, and that is going forward. Jewel mirror samadhi comes to mind. You are not it. It is completely you. Or Dongchan's statement, I am not him. He is completely me. And that means true nature is sort of with you at all times, but you also have this ego idea of you want to get more, you want to take advantage of the situation, etc. And that, in the sense that it's misaligned with the true nature. So your understanding of who is a little bit misaligned. And it's that misalignment, that dukkha, that is the cause of our suffering. It's not our suffering. We won't get rid of. There's old age and death and no extinction of old age and death. There's no old age and death, but also no extinction of it. So yes, I'm a Buddhist, but I'm also a Catholic. And a number of other things. Thank you. Please.
So I'm thinking about this breathing that you need to do when you're doing your meditation, right? Thinking about the breathing and letting it all go. But this whole process of thinking where my breath is a thinking process. So in a way, I'm thinking, or am I not thinking? So I'm not quite sure if I'm just doing my breathing, trying to get this emptiness in my mind, I'm doing it right because I am thinking about my breathing. Do you understand my question?
Yes, thank you. A very simple answer, maybe others would help with that, but when I become aware of thinking, or when I focus on thinking, it's not the thought, it's the sensation and the body and the spine and the legs and the back of my spine and whether my spine is initially correct or not. And then it's just awareness of breathing out. And with that, all the changes in body sensations. So it's more the sensations, the physical aspect that breathing. Breathing is sort of an intermediary. it's not us, but it is not us either. It's not our breath. Essentially, we're not taking in the air, but it is our breath. So it's a little bit paradoxical. In fact, what is it? Is a good question. I would definitely not think about thinking or think not thinking, but instead feel it. And then body sense it. And then let all that go. And do it again. Return.
I like to categorize thinking also, because awareness isn't necessarily thinking, but planning and telling stories would be thinking for me. And so if I find myself drifting off into a plan or drifting off into a story about something that happened, that's the type of thinking that you want to let settle and just go back to awareness.
Thank you. You're not in practicing. Practicing is trying to bring this manifold awareness, ultimately, jewel mind or whatever. But you're not disavowing the normal thinking that you need to do. It's a good thing to do to think. We need to think to plan and to relate and to tell stories and to share joy. So it's a wonderful thing. It's just not the focus of Zazen. Sitting thinking non-thinking. Yes, please.
I've been having to make some big decisions recently, and I'm trying to incorporate, I guess, my meditation practice and that, just to quiet the mind a little bit, but thinking always, you know, comes back up, and it's a factor in decisions that, you know, that are important to make. So I guess just wanted to ask your opinion on how much emphasis you put on thinking rather than, you know, what you're intuitively feeling after a sit.
The emphasis of sitting is not to non-thinking necessarily. It's to the mindfulness, awareness, that sort of thing. So there are many practices of mindfulness that you may be aware of and may be doing. But we, in this tradition, we do focus a lot on the posture and the inner relief, in the Dalai Lama's words, the complete release, letting go of everything. And that sort of brings a base for our existence, for our doing things when we get up and go back up. And that once we get up, we're fully, there's no ordinary mind generally. There's a koan that says ordinary mind is the way, and the Dalai Lama, one of the things that he mentioned is ordinary mind is this innermost awareness, at least in one Tibetan teaching. So we don't disavow anything, don't push away anything, but we don't necessarily grab on to any single thing either. We just practice.
I'm sorry to say that we have to stop because it's lunchtime.
Stop.
Unless anyone had one last piercing question.
Stop, look, and go. There's a lunch, I think. Do you want to?
We will be going up to the residence kitchen. That's the furthest away building. And if everybody could come up fairly quickly so we can all bow in together, and then there's lunch available up there, and we can eat outside if you like.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.